Hello, my name's Dan Kalinske. I'm a QC at Landmark Chambers. One of the areas I specialise in is non-domestic rates. This podcast is going to focus on the collection and enforcement of non-domestic rates. I'm doing that because there have been a couple of recent cases which, although they don't necessarily decide anything particularly new, they do provide an opportunity to consolidate an understanding of this area. Now, the fundamental distinction that I would like to highlight in this area is between, on the one hand, the maintenance, the compilation and maintenance of an accurate rating list, and on the other hand, the collection and enforcement of the rates that are due pursuant to that list. So in the statutory scheme, section 55 of the Local Government Finance Act 1988 provides the foundation for regulations dealing with the alteration of the rating list, and those are the ones which are relevant to the making of proposals, or as it's now understood, the check, challenge and appeal mechanism, which deal with changes to the rating list, be it the way property is shown in that rating list or the rateable values attached to that property. Separately, under section 69 of the 1988 Act, there is provision for collection and enforcement, and Schedule 9 of the Act itself sets out some provisions, and the non-domestic rating collection and enforcement regulations of 1989 provide the detail on which local authorities collect and enforce rates due under the statutory scheme. Now, I would like to highlight in particular Regulation 23.1 of the 1989 regulations, which says that any matter which could be the subject of an appeal under section 55 of the 1988 Act may not be raised in the collection and enforcement proceedings. So the fundamental principle is that you have to take the rating list as you find it in the collection and enforcement world. And understanding that fundamental distinction, the separation between the content of the rating list and the enforcement of the implications of that content as it exists on any given day, is fundamental. Now, that separation may create obstacles for clients in some cases. It may provide opportunities, even windfalls, in other cases. But it is a fundamental feature of the statutory scheme, which practitioners need to understand. So with that fundamental separation in mind, I'm going to just examine briefly a couple of areas which are areas in which litigation frequently arises. So the first one is the question of the timely collection of non-domestic rates. So Regulation 4 of the Collection and Enforcement Regulations is the provision which requires rates to be demanded by the service of a demand notice. And Regulation 5 of those regulations provides that a demand notice shall be served as soon as practicable. Now, there's been a considerable amount of litigation as to the consequences of a failure on the part of the billing authority to demand rates in a timely manner. And that litigation has, I think, settled down into an established position following the case of North Somerset Council and Honda and others. Now, in that case, it was held that if there was a breach of a duty to demand rates as soon as practicable, the consequences of the breach of that duty were not automatic, but depended upon the principles of unconscionability and whether it was unconscionable for rates to be collected, notwithstanding the breach of that statutory duty. And that requires an examination of the extent, if any, to which there is prejudice on the ratepayer, and weighing that against the public interest in the collection of rates. So where we are then is that there will, in circumstances where there is a breach of duty, need to be an inquiry into the extent to which there is prejudice to the ratepayer in order that the magistrate's court can consider the consequences of any breach of statutory duty on the part of the billing authority to demand rates as soon as practicable. But by contrast, the case of Sukarno and Oxford magistrates is a case where there had been a split in the pattern of occupation, And there had been delay on part of the rating authority, but the delay had been on the part of the billing authority supplying information to the valuation officer in order that the valuation officer could consider and ultimately alter the rating list. So all of the relevant delay predated the alteration of the rating list. So the argument was whether this was a case which was on all fours with North Somerset, where there had been a breach of a duty to demand rates as soon as practicable. And the answer was that it wasn't, because the relevant delay was the delay which occurred after the alteration to the rating list. And there wasn't any such delay in the circumstances of Sukarno. And so therefore, there was no barrier to the rating authority enforcing rates in that case, because the relevant delay had been a delay which predated the change to the rating list. So this reinforces the fundamental point that I identified a few moments ago, that it's really important to have in mind the distinction between the maintenance and alteration of the rating list on one hand, and the collection of rates pursuant to that. And the North Somerset principle did not extend to delay which predated the alteration of the rating list, because of the ways in which the statutory duties under the Act had been drawn. So the next area I want to explore is the approach to defending the proposition that a ratepayer is in rateable occupation of the property shown in the rating list. And this is an area where there's been a helpful recent case, the case of Atos IT Services and Flyde District Council, which is a case from the 18th of March 2020. Now, to be completely frank, I don't think this case establishes anything new, but what it does do is it sets out very clearly and very helpfully the approach to rateable occupation. And the key proposition is that a person is not in rateable occupation of a hereditament shown in the rating list if somebody else is in exclusive occupation of part of that hereditament. And this case is a sequel to quite a well-trodden line of cases that isn't always properly understood. And the key cases are Verrill and Hackney, Ford and Burnley, London Borough of Croydon and Maxson. And they all come together and are helpfully set out in this recent case of Atos IT Services and Flyde Borough Council. And in Atos, Mr. Justice Sarney approved the summary from Ride as follows. The occupation of land can be joint, and it is important to distinguish the case of a building in the hands of joint occupiers from that of a building of which the parts are let separately to several persons, each of whom is the occupier of the part let to him and of that part only. If the whole building is entered in the rating list as one rateable hereditament, no one tenant is liable for the rate on the whole, because he is not the occupier of the whole, nor can he be compelled to pay the rate on the part which he occupies, because there is nothing in the rate or in the rating list on which it is based to show what is the value of that part. So that approach does provide a key opportunity to somebody who is sued for the recovery of rates of a property that is larger than the space which he truly occupies. But it only works if somebody else is in occupation of part of the property which is comprised in the entry in the list. If the situation is that the ratepayer is sued and is only occupying part of the hereditament, but the remainder of it is unoccupied, then that will not be, there will not be a defence to that, because Section 43 of the Local Government Finance Act 1988 provides that a person can be liable for the occupation of part of a hereditament. So the key distinction is if there are several occupiers of parts and the whole of the property is in the rating list, then there will be a defence, see the recent Atos case confirming that long line of authority. But if there's only one occupier, albeit of a smaller place, space comprised, and the rest of it is properly analysed unoccupied, then that unfortunate occupier may be liable for the whole of the rates in relation to the hereditament shown in the list. Each of those can be properly understood as the application of an approach that respects the way in which the list is shown as the inexorable starting point of analysis, which all stems back to that separation of functions between the maintenance of the list and the collection pursuant to the list, which is reflected in Regulation 23 of the 1989 regulations that I set out early in this podcast. I would commend the Atos case as a really helpful collection together of an established line of authority, rather than as something that actually establishes anything new, but it is all set out with real clarity in that recent judgment of Mr. Justice Saini. Another key area where one can take the list as one finds it, but potentially have a defence to a claim in the magistrate's court, is where the ratepayer contends that a relief is available, either that the property properly analysed is exempt from rates, or commonly it's entitled to, for example, mandatory charitable relief, where only 20% of the full rate is payable under Section 43(6) of the 1988 Act. And that's a classic case where one can defend the proceedings for the enforcement of rates brought by a rating authority and contend that on a proper legal analysis, those rates are not payable in the amount that is being contended for. Now, a recent case of Nuffield Health shows an alternate approach to defending that in the magistrate's court. In Nuffield Health, the charitable ratepayer ran well-being facilities, which it contended were entitled to mandatory relief for the advancement of health. That was not accepted by the London Borough of Merton, who claimed the full amount of rates that would be payable if no charitable exemption was available. Nuffield Health chose to pay the rates, but to bring an application for a declaration that it was entitled to mandatory relief, and also in restitution for the repayment of the sums that it had paid in excess of its true entitlement to mandatory charitable relief. And Nuffield succeeded in getting the declaration from the court and also in getting an order for the repayment of those sums, together with a modest claim in respect of interest. What this illustrates is that if a charity considers it's entitled to mandatory relief, then it has a range of options. Either it can defend the proceedings in the magistrate's court, or it can take matters into its own hand and seek a declaration. In this instance, that was in the Chancery Division of the High Court. An alternative might be to pursue an application for judicial review in relation to an erroneous refusal for the payment of mandatory relief. But those are the range of considerations, and there are advantages and disadvantages to each of those. I want to just highlight two considerations where there are cases which need to be understood. So the first one is the approach to costs. Now, there is a very protective approach to costs in the magistrates' court proceedings, which protects the billing authority unless it is acting effectively unreasonable. Now, the case you need to be aware of on that is a case called Patel and the London Borough of Camden. And this, the approach to this arises under Section 64 of the Magistrates Court 1980. And the essential reasoning is that in the Magistrates Court, the civil starting point of costs ordinarily following the event does not apply, and the court therefore endorsed a protective approach to billing authorities so as not to impede them acting in the public interest to collect rates. So the upshot of that is that a billing authority might fail in the magistrate's court, but the successful ratepayer might well ordinarily be prevented from recovering the costs of defending the proceedings in the magistrate's court from the billing authority on the basis of this protective approach, so as not to impede the billing authority from exercising its statutory duties in the public interest. So it's important, if you're advising ratepayers, to make them aware that they may be unsuccessful in recovering costs of a successful defence of collection proceedings in the magistrate's court, and that is something that might take many of them by surprise. The other point to be aware of is rights of appeal, because if proceedings start in the magistrate's court, then that is final unless an application is made for a appeal by way of case stated to the High Court. That is an appeal which arises on the basis that the magistrate's court have erred in law in their approach to the enforcement proceedings. That will allow for legal issues to be ventilated in the High Court. The problem, however, arises by a quirk of the rules, which means that there is no further appeal from a case stated appeal to the Court of Appeal. And indeed, in the case of Kenya Aid, not only did the court confirm that there was no right of appeal to the Court of Appeal, but it also ruled as an abuse of process, an attempt to bring a judicial review proceedings for the purpose of allowing a further appeal. So the upshot is, if proceedings are started in the magistrate's court, then they will only be able to go to the High Court, and they will not be able to go to the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court. And this means that there is effectively a cap on the testing of legal points. And that might be a reason, if somebody wants to test a point that is hitherto treated as an established point, that one needs to think about whether actually one instigates proceedings for a declaration if you are the ratepayer, which could then go further to the Court of Appeal and potentially to the Supreme Court if there's a point of public importance. Or if you're the billing authority, you could take the action that was taken in the North Somerset case of actually instigating proceedings in the High Court. A disadvantage of that is that you wouldn't get the cost protection of Patel and Camden, but an advantage is that you would have the opportunity of testing points in the higher courts, which is not available to you if proceedings start in the magistrate's court because of the limits confirmed in the Kenya Aid decision. So I think what this survey of the case law reveals is that there are quite a few technical distinctions here which are it's important to get one's head around. But I come back really to the critical distinction, which is to understand that you have to take the rating list as you find it in collection and enforcement proceedings. And that throws up anomalies, but it also throws up potential opportunities if people understand that separation. And it might, for example, lead to the ability to defend the claim for payment of rates on the basis of the hereditament shown in the rating list. And if that's done successfully, then there might be the opportunity for a correct entry to be made. But it might be that by the time that defence has run its course in the collection proceedings, that the opportunity to alter the rating list has been lost, and one might be able to take advantage of the different time limits. So my overall conclusion is that this is an area of law where the separation throws up opportunities, it throws up potentially anomalies, it throws up in certain circumstances the opportunities for ratepayers to get what people might perceive to be unwelcome windfalls. But all of it really is the functioning of a scheme where there is at the heart of it this important separation between the content of the list and the collection of rates pursuant to that list, which it's essential for those practicing in this area to understand. So that's the conclusion of this podcast. I hope you found it of some interest. If you have any comments or feedback, please do feel free to email me at dkolinsky@landmarkchambers.co.uk. That's dkolinsky at landmarkchambers.co.uk. Thank you very much indeed for listening, and goodbye.